fun.
Fun. Men are more fun than women.
Oh, I didn't say that.
Men have more fun.
Okay. What about discipline? Do you think that that's generally perceived, that men have more discipline, or no? Okay. Right now, what about, are there any that you would say here that women are generally associated with more than?
Emotion, morality, and mystery.
Depends. So emotions. What else did somebody say?
Mystery.
Mystery. Okay. I think you could probably put feelings.
Intuition.
Sensitivity.
Okay.
Sensitivity.
Compassionate.
Okay. Now, I want to ask, and I'm going to, let's do this up here since we're running out of space. Now, if we did this like this, if we put male here and female here, if you were going to tell me what are some negative traits, things that are perceived as negative in either of these. Like one I would put here is that typically we think of males as being very aggressive. Okay,
dominating.
So that, pardon me?
Dominating.
Okay. You can stay suffer.
Females. Oversensitive.
Men?
The female nags.
Pardon me?
Female nags.
Nags? Okay.
Men get angry.
Men get angry.
Men get violent.
Okay.
Women worry.
Women worry. Okay.
Petty.
Who's petty?
Women.
We'll put this one here. All right, now, what we've kind of got out is just some ideas, okay, some attributes and some qualities. And one of the things, now let me ask you this, and then we're going to move in a little bit to the presentation. And what I'm going to do today is we're going to look a little bit at how women have been thought of in Christian thought, and then we're going to look at some contemporary feminist options in response to that. One of the things I'm going to put up here, and I want you to keep in your mind, is this has generally been men, and this, ignore the negative thing here, but men have generally been thought of as the mind, spirit, the rational, the moral, and women have been thought of as fleshy. Okay, so just keep that in mind. We're going to talk about it a lot more. Okay, so there's a few people in the room who I have Bibles. I've given Bibles to, and you'll be on in just a couple minutes. Before we do that, I just want to go over this again for the folks who are new, and we'll do this fairly quickly. And before I move on, I'll have a little time for questions. Before you say, what do feminist theologians say about anthropology? It helps to know what they say, period, okay? And think of this so much as a pendulum on a clock, okay? And for a long time, men did theology, and the emphasis was on this column, okay, when we talk about theology. And now, the feminists are trying to change the direction a little. Okay, so these are seven themes of feminist theology. The first one is immanence over transcendence. So feminist theologians want to emphasize that if Mary was the world and I was God, that we are really close, intimately involved, immanent, rather than the standard image of the world being here and God being out there. Okay. A second point is that one of the main ways we understand God, instead of being, oh, an idea or a thought or a substance that's kind of out floating, that the first thing we say about God is that God is a being in relationship, okay? In relationship. It's really, really important. And when we look at the Old Testament, God is in relationship with the people all the time. So it's very much part of the biblical tradition. Another emphasis that feminists want to make is, instead of saying God doesn't change, God can't change and still be God, God doesn't change, we got that from the Greeks. Feminists want to say, you know what? Look at the Old Testament. God changes. Joan reminded us last night that if you want to see this, she's an Old Testament scholar, that you look up the word repent. and God repents. God changes God's mind, okay? So feminists want to say, hey, let's emphasize this. And instead of categories of salvation, we're all going to get to heaven, and we're really working towards getting to heaven. Feminists and other theologians of liberation want to say, let's talk about changes here and now. Okay, so liberation over salvation. And a similar move is eschatology, which means talk about the last things. Instead of emphasizing that, feminist theologians want to emphasize environmental and ecological concerns. It's about the here and now. And the sixth point is, instead of emphasizing, we've always done this, and the church has always done this, and this is what the church has always taught, feminist theologians want to say, this is my experience, my life-giving experience. You know, Wes has been talking about these radical experiences in the Bible studies, and feminist theologians want to take that seriously. And finally, feminist theologians want to say that all theology, whether you're Augustine writing, you know, 1,500 years ago, or whether you're writing right now, that if I'm sitting here writing theology, all the things around me, being white, being upper middle class, being well educated, speaking English as a first language, they are going to impact the way I do theology. So the context affects it. Instead of saying, I'm writing this theology and this is for all people in all times and places, okay? And so those are seven themes. And this is what we're gonna do today. We're gonna go right through these. Protest and critique. What did the tradition say? Well, you know what? It was only written by men. Let's look at that and see what we find. That moves us into step two, which is to say, what are all these great resources in the tradition that nobody's talked about? Things that have never been translated, things that have never been written about. The recovery of the women mystics, really in the last 15 years, especially Protestants are getting onto that. That's part of this. And finally then, feminists say, what new things am I going to make with these new sources that I found? So it's a new way of doing theology more than it is kind of a package of ideas. Okay, any questions about that before we move into the main piece? Okay. I know that was a little fast, but if you do have a question, we can go back to it later. Okay, what we're going to do now, looking at my clock, is we're going to look at Christian anthropology. We're going to look at a few biblical images, and then we're going to look at some really awful stuff from Augustine, some awful stuff from Aquinas, some not so bad stuff from Luther, and then we're going to start thinking, what are the feminists saying about this? Okay. Of course, the two primary texts that have a huge impact on anthropology in the Old Testament are the two creation accounts in Genesis. And I have asked some people to read them. Does somebody have Genesis 1, 26 through 27? Go for it, Virginia. And read loud.
Then God said, let us make humankind in our image, according to our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the birds in the air, and over the cattle, and over all the wild animals of the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps upon the earth. So God created humankind in his image. In the image of God, he created them. Male and female, he created them.
Okay. Thank you. And somebody else has Genesis 2?
Yes. Then the Lord God said, it is not good that man should be alone. I will make him a helper as his partner. And so the Lord God caused a deep sleep to fall upon the man, and he slept. And he took one of his ribs and closed up its flesh place with flesh. And the rib that the Lord God had taken from the man, he made into a woman and brought her to the man. Then the man said, this at last is bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. This one shall be called woman, for out of man this one was taken.
Okay, now I want to ask you, let's do this. Right. Which of the two stories, the first one Virginia read, they were created male and female at the same time, and the second story, which Pastor Sharon read, well, we all know that one came out. All right, so my question is, which of those stories have you heard most in your churches, and in which one do you think we hear most in popular culture Bible stories?
Second one.
Okay. All right, so let's just work through these just a little bit. If we need to, we'll go back and read them. Okay, so in the first one, they are made, what? Together, right? At the same time. Okay, in the second one, we got Adam. Then Eve. Okay. Do you notice any other differences in the stories? Anything else besides just the timing?
In Genesis 1, they are to have dominion over things, and in Genesis 2, Eve is made as a helper and a companion.
So, Ruth, would it work if I put joint dominion versus woman as helper, or sometimes it's translated helpmate?
Or companion, like Ruth.
Okay. Yeah, I think, I don't know, is that the NRSV? Does it say companion?
Partner.
Helper as his partner, okay. All right, one of the other things about the creation stories that's very interesting is that, Joan, you're gonna help me out here.
Okay.
What does that word mean?
Adam is a word play on the word Adama for soil.
For soil.
It's a word play.
Dirt. Right, it's dirt. It's not a first name, okay? And that's one of those things that you think, I guarantee you, maybe you'll be on the boat and you'll think, man, aren't we there yet? And you'll think, wow, Adam isn't a first name. I mean, that can change the whole way you think of creation. Instead of, hi, I'm Adam, and I'm asleep now, and now there's Eve. Instead, you get this story where you have people made of dirt together, male and female. I was working on doing some editing for a professor recently, and he very clearly goes into this and says Adam is not a first name, but then through the whole book he writes it with a capital A. And I told him, if you really want to stick to it, write it
the man.
Like that. Okay? So just if you don't remember anything else I said today, keep that in mind, that Adam means soil.
Yeah. What does Eve mean?
Living.
Living. Yeah.
It's not living.
Just
soil
living.
Soil and the living.
Mm-hmm. Soil and the living. Okay, so I think that's really cool. We can talk about this all day, but we gotta keep moving. Okay. So these are the two dominant creation stories in Genesis, which flavor the whole Hebrew Scriptures. And we've all agreed, I think, that this is the one that we all heard the most. And we all continually hear the most, okay? Yeah,
I have another point to add up there. In the first one, in the second one, Genesis 2, woman is taken from man. As
absolutely.
A man giving birth to woman.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And the other one is God making both, giving birth to both.
And that's going to come up in the Corinthians text that we're going to get to right now.
But the other thing is that word for helpmate is only used of a woman and of God.
Okay.
The only used word of the woman here and of God in other places in the Hebrew Bible.
Okay, now let's look a little bit at the New Testament. We're just going to kind of keep moving because, like I said, we could stay on this all day. And if Joan's really nice, maybe she can field some questions after class, too.
Okay.
All right. Now, New Testament anthropology, of course, inherited lots from the Jewish background, the ancient Near Eastern background, and also from the Hellenistic context in which the church arose. And one of the, especially for Lutherans who love Paul had this kind of schizophrenic stuff going on, okay? We have two competing ideals in Paul. First, the equivalence of all people in Christ, okay? And then the second is really very clearly that women are subordinate. If I could ask whoever has the 1 Corinthians 11 passage.
11:3 verses 8?
Yes, sir.
All right. But I want you to understand that the head of every man is Christ. The head of a woman is her husband, and the head of Christ is God. Any man who prays or prophesies with his head covered dishonors his head. But any woman who prays or prophesies with her head unveiled dishonors her head. It is the same as if her head were shaven. For if a woman will not veil herself, then she should cut her hair. But if it be disgraceful for a woman to be shorn or shaven, let her wear a veil. For a man ought not cover his head, since he is the image and glory of God, but a woman is the glory of man. For a man was not made from woman, but woman from man.
There you go. See? Okay, and now let's have the competing one, which is the one we all like to quote all the time when we're talking about how welcoming the church is to women. Who's got Galatians 3?
There is no longer Jew or Greek. There is no longer slave or free. There is no longer male and female. For all of you are one in Christ Jesus. And if you belong to Christ, then you are Abram's offspring, heirs according to the promise.
Okay, so what we've got really in the tradition is some sort of real schizophrenia. Okay, there's a tradition of women and men being equal in God's sight and also in possessing the image of God. And then there's also a tradition, which is probably the more dominant tradition, if you had to go one way or the other, that says women are secondary. They were made second. They sin first. That's tomorrow's lecture. And that they're the ones that lead men into temptation. So keep that in mind, okay? But definitely we all know which tradition has been dominant, okay? So now we're going to leave the Bible, just set it aside for a minute. We're going to look a little bit at the context in which Christian theology emerged. We're going to start with Augustine. Remember I put up here before, let me put that back up here, that men, spirit, women, flesh. Okay. So keep that in the back of your mind. In the Greek view, male consciousness is seen as transcendent and free from nature. Okay. Remember how I said when I had my list of seven that God had to be kept up and untouched and unspoiled by nature and change? That's the Greek ideal for the Greek male mind, is that it's going to be this pure rational thing, and I'm never hungry, and I never want to have sex, and I never want to go to the bathroom. I'm just going to control my emotions rationally and just move through the world. Okay? So keep that in mind. Okay, what happens is the mind gets trapped. You get trapped in this fleshy matter. And there's all this cool stuff about hot and cold, and men are hot and women are cold, and it gets really weird. Okay, but what this does is it creates a chain of command. We talked about this last night. God, the pure idea, is at the top, and then there's men, and then there's women, and then there's children, and then there's slaves, and then there's animals, and then there's the earth, okay? And that is still with us today, okay? So onto the scene, verse Augustine, major, major Christian thinker. You cannot do theology without understanding Augustine or his continued influence. And Augustine bought into all this, especially later in his life. He had a lover for a long time. He had a great sex life, so we know. And then he went through this whole thing, and then he became very anti-pleasure, anti-sex, anti-physical. I mean, it's really amazing when you read it. You think, how could this guy get from here to here? You know? Okay, so Augustine bought into this whole thing of assigning to males the higher spiritual nature and to females the lower. He writes in his book on the Trinity, "I was treating of the nature of the human mind, that the woman together with her own husband is the image of God, so that the whole substance may be one image. But when she is referred to separately in her quality as helpmeet, which regards the woman alone, then she is not the image of God. But as regards the man alone, he is the image of God as fully and completely as when the woman too is joined with him in one. So if he's alone, he's the image of God. She's alone, she's not." He also says, "In paradise, men will rule and women will obey, and both will be perfectly happy." I wonder, talk about universal in context, okay? And one of the things to keep in mind here, as we do this whole conversation, and it's going to come up all week and all the feminist stuff, is this dualistic worldview, okay? And that's what a lot of the feminist theologians want to say, is that, you know what? This boundary has all these holes in it. And there really is no pure spirit, and there really is no pure flesh. But Augustine thought there was, okay? As did someone who followed him, Thomas Aquinas, who based his anthropology on Aristotle. Remember, in the Middle Ages, we have the recovery of the classic text, okay? Aquinas adopted Aristotle's belief that women are misbegotten males. Females are accidents or ovens. That's one way of thinking of it. He wrote, "For man is the beginning and end of woman, just as God is the beginning and end of all creation." He also wrote in Generation of Animals, "Thus the physical part, the body, comes from the female." "And the soul from the male, since the soul is the essence of a particular body, just as it sometimes happens that deformed offspring are produced by deformed parents and sometimes not. So the offspring produced by a female are sometimes female, sometimes not, but male. The reason is that the female is, as it were, a deformed male." Okay. And we read this now and we think, isn't that gross? Isn't that upsetting? And don't let yourself think that nobody thinks that way anymore, because the impact of these two thinkers on philosophy and Christian theology in the West is just, you can't even conceive of it, you know, without these two thinkers. Fortunately, Luther's a little better. Okay, one of the cool things about Luther was he thought the body was pretty darn good, and he thought sex was great because it makes children. Okay, and the family was all important. Marcia's been talking about that in her sessions. According to Luther, he writes, "The female sex is, quote, weaker, carrying about in the mind and body several vices, but that one good, however, covers all and conceals all of them, the womb and birth. So even though women were better, what really made us better was the fact that we could make more little Christians." Okay, but it's interesting that for Luther, there was no stigma about intercourse in marriage. And the curse was barrenness. That was a really awful thing, and he wrote about that and talked about that. So he's a little better. And Calvin didn't get so much into it from the perspective of sexuality and keeping women down because they were more fleshy. He just thought that he had a very ordered view of God's creation, and that women being below men is part of the divinely ordained social order. But it didn't really have anything to do with Eve sinning first or Eve having less of the Imago Dei. So in the Reformers, there's a little bit of an improvement, but not a whole lot. So you can't really go around saying Luther was pro-woman. He wasn't bad, but he had a long way to go. Okay, so now we've done a little bit of history. And let me just tell you about a few feminist theologians and what they're saying in response to this. And what I'd like to do is talk for about 12, 15 minutes and have a good 10, 15 minutes for discussion at the end. Okay, I've already mentioned some of them, so I'll just go through them quickly. One is, feminist theologians want to say this line between spirit and flesh, male and female, just doesn't exist. Okay, and if you've been going to the sessions on the brain, we know that now that our brain is affected by what happens in our body, and our body is affected by what happens in our brain. So modern science is teaching us now about the breaking down of these boundaries. And a lot of that started with the onset of modern science and modern psychological methods. Okay, so that's one thing that feminists want to rethink. Another emphasis, and we'll talk about this a lot tomorrow, is feminists want to reject the idea, we didn't talk about this before when we talked about the garden, but who was the first to sin? She was a she. Who was the first to sin?
Eve.
Okay, and what did she do to Adam? She
gave it to him.
She tempted him. Okay, so Eve was the first to sin and the one who led man to sin. And feminists want to say, that's a bunch of garbage. They want to stick with the first Genesis account that Virginia read. One of the things that's happened in the church that feminists have been highly critical of is women have had two options, two ways to be. You can be like Eve, or who do you think's on the other side?
Mary.
There we go, because remember, this is dualistic thinking. And as, I forget your name?
Judy
said last night, Mary was ever virgin. That was Vatican I? Or, no, that was like the 50s, right?
When they started to decide who was Jesus, then they had to come to terms with who was Mary, and that's where they came up with her being ever virgin.
Right.
Because she's really the spouse of the Holy Spirit, who gave birth to her son. Yeah.
Right.
It's all one.
Right, and this is really important because this is the way, two ways that women have been able to be in the church. You're either a wife or a mother, in which you're really kind of on this fleshy side. Or else, you're a celibate nun. And then you're okay. Because then you're not really a woman because you don't really have sex. So then you're really more like a man if you're celibate. Okay, so it gets very complicated. But again, this is something feminist theologians want to reject, these two options. Another main point, and I said this before, I'll just reiterate it, is feminist theologians prefer to draw on the Genesis 1 account of creation. Okay? And so those are pretty general things. And now we're going to look at two specific theologians. One, again, is Rosemary Ruther. And what does she say about all this? And then the second, if we have time, we'll get to two or three other people and what they do.
Okay.
It's really interesting that in anthropology there have been three different types of feminist anthropologies that have been out there now for quite a while. One is, I'm not liking this picture, eschatological, which means to talk about the last thing. Thank you. It's hard to spell on the board.
Yes.
Okay, eschatological feminism. And this was, if you think about the time of the first Christians, they were radical, egalitarian, these are big words, egalitarian, apocalyptic communities. And these were the people who really did give everything to the poor. And they really did live as equals. And they thought Jesus was coming back tomorrow. Okay, so this is one option. A second option, which is what most of us live in, is called liberal feminism. And most of us are familiar with this because we hear talk of human rights and women's rights. And what's at the basis, if I want to say women have the right to vote, why would I say that? We've all heard it.
Because women are created equal.
Okay, the belief here is that men and women are equal in creation. Okay, so that's option number two. And a third option, which we think of, I always think of Mary Poppins, because you really do see it in the parents in Mary Poppins, is this, it's the Victorian romantic feminism. Okay, and the idea there is that men and women are kind of like this. They're different, but they complement each other. You know, remember the men's movement, Robert Bly and stuff, what, about 10 years ago? And I mean, it's still popular, it's very important, but there was this whole thing that, oh, we can get together and, you know, we can complement each other, yin and yang. So this is the view of romantic feminism. Whereas if you were going to draw liberal feminism, it would kind of look more like this, that we're equal from the start. And this emphasizes difference. Okay, so those are three choices that are really out there. And Rosemary Ruther comes on the scene, and she says, she also sees these two streams we talked about in Christian anthropology. It's kind of schizophrenia. And she says, what are we going to do about this? Well, she looks at these and she says, well, eschatological feminism really isn't around much anymore. In some communities, some Shaker communities, Quakers might see it a little bit. The two models that most of us have experienced are these. And the first thing she says is, I would like to form a synthesis between these two, liberal and romantic. Okay, the problem with liberal feminism is that the ideal person is still conceived of in male terms. Rational, moral, autonomous, reasonable. Okay, so the only way for women to succeed in that model is to be like men. Okay? Romantic feminism idealizes women in nature. Okay? And the problem with this, she says, is it has no way to account for the violence we see in the world around us. Okay? It doesn't account for the pain. Okay? It's kind of just, it's a very romantic idea of the way the world works. So what Ruther wants to propose is what she calls, it's a big name, psychic integration of the whole self. Okay? She proposes a redeemed humanity, and she wants to recover all these capacities, okay, into the human person without having this kind of split. And I'm going to read you a quote. She says it better than I certainly could. This is from her book, Religion and Sexism. Women should not identify themselves with those repressed parts of the male psyche that males have projected upon them as feminine. So she doesn't want women to just do the ones that do all the feeling and all the emotion.
Okay.
Nor should they adopt the male one-sided psychic profile that identifies the ego with linear, rational types of thinking.
Okay.
And that's what we see here. Rather, women need to appropriate and deepen the integration of the whole self, relational with rational modes of thought. That's already theirs. This may mean that they need to extend the development of those capacities for rational thought that have culturally been denied them. Okay? They need to do this not in a dualistic way, but in a way that integrates these capacities with relational modes of thought. So that's why, even though it's a terrible chicken scratch of a drawing, this is what she's trying to do. She wants to bring together what we've understood as male and female, but she doesn't want to do it with that boundary. She wants all of us to come to integration of the rational and the emotional. Okay. Any questions about the Ruther's proposal before I move on?
What does she call that again?
What's a big name? Psychic integration of the whole self. Okay.
Thank you.
Now, another approach that's really interesting, especially here at Holden, is done by a woman named Ann Clifford, and she's an eco-feminist. Okay. And ecofeminism is concerned with the destruction of the earth and oppression of women and sees all of life as a gift and interconnected. It denounces capitalism, dangerous technologies, and it wants to rethink many of these categories. And I think what I'm going to do is so I can move over up there. Let's turn this down. Okay, now, let me ask you, if here's God, okay, and here's the world, in traditional Christian theology, who has been at the center of creation?
Man.
Let's be nice, and we'll just say the human person, even. But man, the human person has been at the center of creation. Okay. And power structures have been conceived, we used this word a lot yesterday, hierarchically. Okay. And I drew that when I had that triangle up at the board. And remember, we had men, women, children, slaves, animals, and what's at the very bottom?
Earth.
The earth. Okay. So if you're an eco-feminist, you can see already there's going to be a lot of problems with that model. Clifford asks, when does being human become truly earthly? And what she wants to do is instead of this kind of model, okay, what she wants to draw is here's the world and here are all the creatures. Animals, people, trees, flowers, compost, bears. Okay, but all creation has the same value. Okay, rather than this kind of structure. Okay, and in terms of the power structures, she wants to talk about egalitarian holism, and there's no way to draw that. So I'm not even going to try. Okay, one of the things that Clifford really wants to do is say that we can't use the Bible to justify the subordination of nature. She uses the Genesis 1 account, and interestingly enough, you know, we've all been told for a long time that we're stewards of creation. She rejects that model, too, because it's very paternalistic. Since stewardship interprets the Garden of Eden as made for human use, it implies a divinely sanctioned instrumental management of non-human nature for human benefit. She proposes an eco-feminist theology of solidarity. So solidarity, not stewardship. In which God isn't a distant maker, but God is the source and goal. And it's interesting, she doesn't do the Adam, Adama, but she talks about that we too are made of dirt. So think of it, it's a slightly different move. Ruth is really concerned about male, female, okay? And what Clifford is concerned about is the relation of the whole human person to the earth. So she's not so much concerned with issues of male and female. She wants to rethink this whole system of power. Okay, and I find it a very convincing argument. The more I read of ecofeminism,
what's her name?
Let me give it to you right. Is Ann Clifford?
Is she in the bibliography?
I'm working on my bibliography, but she's on it. There's a really wonderful book. If you want to read about anthropology, called In the Embrace of God. And they don't have it in the bookstore, and I'm going to try to get them to have it in the bookstore. And it's a reader. It's got about 10 chapters. And then the other thing feminist theologians make when they're talking about Christian anthropology, and then we talked about Ruther's proposal, which, if you can make any sense of this board, looks like this. And then we talked about Ann Clifford's proposal, which is more than just, it's like she's completely outside the category of male and female. She's rethinking the human person in relationship to everything. And I wanted to give you two kind of different models to look at. So I'm going to stop talking now and see what kind of questions or discussion you guys want to generate. And if you want, we can go back to the list that we started at the beginning. So questions? Yeah, Joan.
This is a little off the wall, but does Clifford do anything with the concept of chaos and disorder?
You know, she doesn't, at least in what I've read of her. Joan's asking if she does anything with chaos theory and disorder.
No, not chaos theory,
just chaos.
We know in the 20th century, but the whole idea that in the first chapter of Genesis is that God creates order out of the chaos, which is pre-existing.
Not to my knowledge. Okay. Not to my knowledge. The one other thing that you just sparked for me that I would just like to say is, I should have mentioned it under general traits that feminist theologians want to take in anthropology is, instead of thinking of, here's the garden.
I should go out here.
Here's the garden, and everybody's happy, right? Everybody's cruising along, no sin yet, so everyone's reasonably happy. Then we have the fall, and we fall. And then, now, traditionally, theologians have thought about getting back to here, okay? One of the things that certain feminist theologians want to talk about, and there's a Lutheran, actually two Lutheran theologians, Wolfhart Pfannenberg and Ted Peters, both who are going to be here in September, talk about, is instead of trying to get back and having this image of the human person be the one that guides us and shapes our ideas, what if we think about the new human person that we're going to be in God's new creation? So instead of trying to get back to this ideal that probably never really existed, so it's a change in perspective. I don't know if this is making any sense, but Mary Hilker does a lot of work. She has an eschatological anthropology where she talks about, let's work towards being the people we're going to be in the new creation instead of trying to get back to this ideal. And again, it's one of those things that sounds simple to say, but if you really think about it, it's very dramatic. More questions? Yes?
Do any of the feminist theologians write about the more medical, psychological thinking that every human being, whether male or female, has within them all the feminine and masculine characteristics, and it's on a continuum?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, that very much is a part of, I'm thinking of three or four people now, and generally what a lot of the feminists do is say, we now know, modern science is teaching us, that we all have this full range of emotions, we all have this full range of rationality and morality, and they acknowledge that, no problem. But what they also acknowledge is, and remember I said earlier, it gets back to context, is that even if I say, okay, you know, here's Judy, and here's Billy, and we'll put a hat on Billy. Okay, there's Judy and Billy, and they really do have a full range of all these qualities and all these attributes. The feminist theologians are perfectly happy to say that, but then you know what happens? Judy and Billy turn on TV, and they go to church, and they read their story Bible. And the culture itself so informs and drives our categories of gender and behavior that there is no pure Judy and Billy. So they very much acknowledge the debate, and there's a lot of really interesting work being done by feminist scientists and brain, body-mind connection and things like that. So, more questions? Okay. All right. Well, we've got about 5 minutes, so I'm not sure.
I know it's a very complex issue, and I don't want to oversimplify it, but I keep wondering, I listen to you and I listen to Wes Barnbrook and others, and I'm wondering if a great deal of our difficulty is in our too literal interpretation of the Bible. very often in our churches, in our congregations, I think.
How would you, can you give me an example of that, say with like the creation story?
The creation story itself, taking that as a, rather than as a symbolic story of the way the world might have begun, and saying that God is behind it. They get too caught up, even in the writing, the men who wrote it, they're too caught up in the details of it, for example. And as we read it, we take that very often, I think, without thinking about it, as literally soul.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely. I agree. Ruth, did you want to respond to that?
Well, in addition to the too literal thinking, you said something yesterday about which laws do we choose to obey and which do we not. Every time I think that I'm surprised that people are surprised that there are two creation stories.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
It's, you know, every time that I go teach Genesis, they say, what do you mean two creation stories? And I take for granted that I shouldn't take. Mm-hmm. And so it's which one have we chosen, which are we going out?
Right. Well, that was just awakened in me again this week. I've known there's been two creation stories. I've known there've been two trees in the garden.
Mm-hmm.
But what has been in my mind so much is the second creation story, and it's the tree of good and evil that is always. It's always been that one tree that has been so powerful to me, and that all stems to in the second. And I just.
Well,
I've grown up in the tradition, I know it, but it's so powerful that that's what's led me a lot of my life.
And that's why, you know, it may seem weird to think, well, why are we talking about anthropology? Why are we talking about God? Or why are we still talking about Jesus after all this time? Because these images are so powerful. I had a friend, we were talking one night, and she said, you know, when I hear these Bible stories, she said, I see the pictures from my storybook. And it was a Concordia Bible storybook from like 1952. The pictures are just awful. You know, but that's it. And if we think that those ever leave us, there's another hand. Now, Bruce?
Obviously, certain portions of the Bible were written by men. Do the feminist theologians point out portions of the Bible that may well have been written by women?
Joan would be much more qualified to answer that question than I would. And not to my knowledge. It's not... One of the things, remember how I just said this about whatever they were, Billy and Judy? Okay. One of the things is, even if there are a few, like Miriam's song, even if there are a few texts that we think, wow, you know, this came out of a voice of a woman and it's a really old section of the Bible, the reality has been that for so long it's been controlled and taught and exegeted out of existence by men. So, and I don't know, Joan, why don't you take
a step too? Well, the same thing, she made the comment about the ancient Near Eastern context of the goddess stories, and the scholars who read the materials will tell us, yeah, but all of the things that are written down in that ancient Near Eastern context about goddesses are written out of a patriarchal society, and they serve the needs of their societies, which you would expect. So don't go looking for any kind of liberation for women in that stuff. You might be able to use it subversively, but it's not there in their culture.
There's one feminist anthropologist whose name escapes me, who Ruther uses, who's reasonably new. It's a pretty interesting theory. And that theory is that when these ancient societies in the ancient Near East went from hunter-gatherer to agrarian societies, that growing seeds and harvesting was a task of women. And this anthropologist's theory is that women were actually the first ones to write and use accounting because they were in charge of the seeds and the harvesting. And then somewhere at some point, then that became a male task. And it's all very, you know, we get pieces and we get flavors and we get possibilities. But it's intriguing nonetheless. There was another question in the back. Yeah.
Maybe just an observation or a expression of frustration in that, I mean, I love hearing these ideas in a council like this, but how do you, I get so frustrated because people have been working for so long to change the way we worship, and it's driving people out of the church.
Absolutely.
And the question then is, which I don't expect an answer for, how do we implement this stuff?
Well, it'd be interesting. Let me respond, and then I know there's some pastors in the room, and they might want to take a stab at it. But the one thing that I always think is, I mean, really, when you talk about theologies of liberation, okay, they've really only been around, I mean, since the 60s. So in terms of Christian history being 2,000 years old, it's, remember when Carl Sagan did, you know, Cosmos, billions and billions and billions, and he had that thing, and the timeline was like 5 miles long, and humans were like a speck at the very end. So keep that in perspective, the tide that we are fighting back. And then I think the second thing is to even entertain these ideas with two or three other people in your context, to even say to your pastor, could we at least talk about inclusive language again? Or could we even talk about, could we do a Bible study on Genesis? Just small acts of subversion. And then I'd like to hear, I know there's some clergy in the room, and I don't know if they want to chime in, or if anybody else has ideas about how you take these and then go home with them.
Well, I just want to, small acts of subversion is your suggestion. Yes?
That's my policy, personally. Okay. I'm not saying it worked for you, but... Did anybody want to respond to this? I mean, this is something we all face.
One of the ways that we've done it in our congregation is through things like Welcome Sunday. You can be at least...
Could you say what that is for the non-Lutherans in the room?
Well, the women of the ELCA have a thank offering Sunday at least once a year. And every once in a while we have it twice a year. And we use a lot of inclusive language. And we get a lot of different people who aren't lay readers or lay liturgists to come up and do that. So it's not the people who are usually doing it, but they hear it, and then there are people who say, I really like that, and it's like, okay, would you like to start doing this? And it's a way of getting a little bit more language in there.
Mm-hmm. Anybody else's ideas that have worked out?
I think to use, as I suppose in our churches, we do more inclusive language in our Bibles, for one thing, which some of the newer translations are trying to do some of that. Probably not far enough, but...
Right.
And then also, I think our hymns are just devastating sometimes with their language. If we could just rewrite the words to some of our music in our hymns,
right,
it would be helpful.
And we're going to, next week, we'll be doing a week-long session on hymnody, and we're going to talk about the lot. And the powerful images in hymns.
Quick example, it was just devastating to me, and I'm a parish pastor, but... And one of my favorite hymns, unfortunately, in a sense, I'm sorry, ladies, this is my father's world.
There you go.
You know, it's really out of greed, this is my creator's world. Mm-hmm. You know. And anyway, I had visited a person in the community, a family, and they were interested in the congregation, and they were going to come visit, and I knew that the woman in the family was a very strong feminist, you know. And when I knew they were coming the next Sunday, I thought, oh, Lord. So I tried to prepare them, because I knew one of the hymns that had been picked was, This is My Father's World.
Yeah.
And I tried to explain that to them. And even so, I knew that after we had sung that hymn, I'd never see them again. And we didn't. Mm-hmm. And we didn't see them again. No, no matter how much I tried to explain.
That's a really important point. Yeah, that people leave. Anytime we come to a session like this on any types of theology, we always have to ask, who is being excluded by what I am saying or speaking or reading or preaching? And that always, I think that should always be a question that we ask. Because if we think that this is just all ideas that well-educated white people talk about and it really doesn't matter, you are wrong. I have women come up to me all the time who say, how can you stay in the Christian church? How can you stay in the Lutheran church? And myself, I mean, I'm not mainstream Lutheran, and I'm here defending the ELCA, I mean, on a daily basis in California. So if you think that these issues don't push people out of the church, you're wrong. And it happens all the time. I hate to end on such a depressing note, so I'm not going to. And I'm going to ask for one more question, and then somebody's going to read something. Yeah, I'll get both.
I just have to make a comment. I have a woman as a pastor for the first time in my life, and I love it. Mm-hmm. And I see that as change.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. And a friend of mine's little girl, they had two women pastors, and then they were going to get a man pastor. And the little girl said, men can't be pastors.
Whoa.
That happened in Shishra.
Yeah. And Mary Beth?
Well, I think that
what we're left with a lot of times is our creative religious imagination. And I think that's very powerful. It's not to be underestimated how, if Jesus said the kingdom is within, the kingdom is here, it's now, and it lies within all of us, the capacity to reimagine some of these stories in the light of who wasn't there or who we're not hearing about in these stories, you know, from their viewpoint, it's very powerful. And that's what's happening in the I think the ELCA, the reimaginings, the women's gatherings that are happening, they're very powerful and often spark terrible hatred and awful things, but people are so threatened by this religious imagination reclaiming the voices that have been lost and imagining what they would have said and how threatening that is, but at the same time how freeing it is too. And I think we have to take the fear seriously of why people are so threatened and address those, and especially those of you who are pastors can have that power to address that fear. But also we have to take risks and dare to imagine and reimagine a whole different way of seeing God and speaking of that God, because language is so powerful.
Well, in one way, let me make one comment and then we'll close. One way to think about it is, what did Jesus do? Jesus walked around and told people stories, new images. God is a shepherd. God is a woman looking for a coin. The mustard seed is the kingdom of God. And all the parables that we can all think of, what are those? They're images. And if Jesus chose to communicate the most important message in the world using images and ideas, it tells us how radically powerful these can be in our own lives. We're going to close with a poem written by
Judy Chicago.
Thank you, Judy Chicago. I was going to say class now. And again, that's one thing that feminist theologians do, is they imagine. They look ahead to the new tomorrow rather than looking back to the garden. And this is just a beautiful poem.
So it begins. And then all that has divided us will merge. And then compassion will be wedded to power. And then softness will come to a world that is harsh and unkind. And then both men and women will be gentle. And then both women and men will be strong. And then no person will be subject to another's will, and then all will be rich and free and varied, and then the greed of some will give way to the needs of many, and then all will share equally in the earth's abundance, and then all will care for the sick and the weak and the old, and then all will nurture the young, and then all will cherish life's creatures, and then all will live in harmony with each other and the earth. And then everywhere will be called Eden once again.
Thank you. Thank you.